Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing.
Joining me in the studio is Toby Miller, who is the chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. After working in broadcasting, banking, and civil service, Toby Miller became an academic in the late 1980s and went on to become one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. In this month, he becomes the director of the City University of London's Centre for the Study of Cultural and Creative Industries. His books include Technologies of Truth, Cultural Citizenship and the Popular Media, Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, the United States of Reinvention, and his latest book, just out, co-authored with Richard Maxwell, is Greening the Media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Hi, Ian. Great to be back. Yeah.
Even though what you're talking about here is that a lot of what we assumed about the technology that, it's easy to hate the Koch brothers, and it's easy to love the late Steve Jobs, as many people do. They see Silicon Valley and the products they make as being virtuous, and there's no question how malignant the Kochs are. But there's another story to this. I mean, we heard about the working conditions in China that make the Apple products. Some of that was overstated by a non-journalist. But on the other hand, there's no question that there's a lot of truth to it. What you're talking about here in the book is about the enormous amount of e-waste that's going on and the incredibly toxic nature of it.
That's right, Ian.
Among other things.
Yeah, we go back and try to give, if you like, an alternative history of the media so people can rethink the beginnings of the print medium, you know, going back to Gutenberg in Germany centuries ago, right through to what happens with our cell phones today. And really there are, I think, three aspects that we look at. One is questions of manufacture. In other words, what are the environmental impacts and the occupational safety and health impacts on the wider ecology, but also on the workers who manufacture everything from the news, from this radio program, through to cell phones. Secondly, what are the costs ecologically and the impact environmentally on individuals of use of these technologies? And thirdly, what's the impact later on in their, if you like, post-consumer existence, their post-use afterlife? And that is what's often referred to, especially in the United States, as e-waste or electronic waste. As you said, lots of us have become aware in the last 6 months, round about the time of the hagiographies that were being written and spoken of for Steve Jobs at his passing, of the appalling working conditions of people employed by Foxconn, which is a large Taiwanese firm with over 1 million employees, most of them in mainland China, who make iPads, iPods, iPhones, and all the other gadgets that you and I, or certainly I, love. We're all aware of that. And I think we're equally aware of the conflict minerals war in Congo, where part of the civil war and the horrendous things that go on between militias and the general population.
5 million people have died.
5 million people died go on because of coltan, which is this mineral that's essential for cell phones and other products. And a lot of the guns that are run and bought by the militias are made available as a consequence of the sale of these minerals to other countries. And they enslave very young boys and girls to work in the mines to generate them. People are somewhat aware of that. There's a jointly sponsored piece of legislation that's gone through the Congress about it in the last couple of years. So those are the two big ticket items that we know about. But the story is deeper and wider than that. Yeah. If you go back to when you and I were young, Ian, which obviously from our accents was in another country and obviously from looking at us was many decades ago, the place currently occupied in the restaurant table by the cell phone was occupied by the packet of cigarettes. Literally, they're placed in the same location. Literally, they're used for the same purpose. When people are bored or waiting or on their own or demoralized, they used to light a cigarette from the little box that was on the left or the right of them on the restaurant table. Now they pick up the cell phone. Now, what's interesting is that regardless of what one thinks of the content of those conversations, because I certainly have conducted mostly trivial conversations for the 50 years that I've been speaking English, regardless of what one thinks of the content, I don't think there's any doubt that we're at a moment when, in terms of health concerns, not only the manufacturing componentry of cell phones, but also their use, is leading to great controversy. I mean, one study says one thing, one says another. But there are lots of suggestions, unsubstantiated so far, that cell phone use can expose users to all kinds of dangerous substances, and that in particular, not just the electromagnetic fields, but also the Wi-Fi systems that we now have as part of our everyday lives everywhere we go, including here in the KPFK studios, may have invidious health effects. Now, as I say, the jury is out scientifically and medically on this, but the fact is it's not inconceivable that in 20 years' time, the kinds of things that are said now about the health impacts of those cigarettes sitting next to you 30 years ago on the restaurant table will be accusations leveled at the cell phone sitting next to you in front of you at the restaurant table.
Well, but what's wrong with, you know, having a conversation? I mean, why text, you know, instead of talking to somebody? That's what worries me, is that we'll become, we're becoming less social beings and more isolated and more not introverted, not introspective, but just isolated.
Yeah, insular.
I understand
that argument, Ian. On the other hand, one can say that particularly with the new systems that allow you to include large numbers of people within your texting regime, it in fact becomes possible to share your somewhat personal private thoughts, share where you are and so on with large numbers of people, and then they can pitch in as well. So ideally, one could argue that this is a way of expanding one's social horizon rather than diminishing it. I understand your skepticism. I just want to suggest that there's another side to the argument as well.
Right. Well, I know. I am afflicted by this thing called LinkedIn. I don't know how I ever got into it.
Oh, it's a shocker.
And every day I get people are saying, you know, accept me as their friends or something, and I don't know who the half of them are. And
they're all masseurs.
And then when I reject them, when I don't respond, people think I'm slighting them. So, you know, you're being automatically cast as some kind of social climber on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you're being automatically cast as being unfriendly. And this is all imposed upon you by some goddamn machine.
Well, some of it's a machine, and some of it's about software and inventive businesses.
Well, I'm in the industrial age, obviously.
We're in the midst of this extraordinary opportunity, in inverted commas, for people essentially to buy shares in Facebook from Mark Zuckerberg and his friends who are dumping them on a cruelly unsuspecting public.
Right. Well, and one of them's avoiding taxes by living in Singapore.
Well, by ceasing to be an American,
right,
goddammit.
And Chuck Schumer went after him today. And of course, I just saw a clip from Fox News where they were defending this guy, saying that the government was trying to take away his money. I mean, that's amazing, the stuff that you hear on Fox News.
But listen, one of the stories about Facebook that matters to me in terms of this book, for what it's worth, in the case of Facebook, obviously there's the concern about the way in which our interpersonal interactions are being corralled in the name of corporate intelligence, corporate knowledge of everything we do. I appreciate that. There's also the fact that in order for it to service its hundreds of millions of users, Facebook, just like Google, just like all the big enterprises, is using massive server farms all over the country and all over the world. These server farms are what you might think of in the analog era as being very large telephone exchanges, but they're the things that are necessary in order to power and to circulate all the information and communication technology we use, whether it's a cloud, or whether it's getting software updates from Microsoft, or whether it is getting intelligence from Google. All of these require massive amounts of electricity. Now, in some cases, some of these companies are careful to use alternative energy sources. The vast majority, however, this applies to Apple and all the big corporations we're talking about, are utilizing either coal-fired or nuclear systems, in most cases coal-fired. So one of the hidden costs of what seems to be a lovely green industry, without all the obvious pollution you get from manufacturing or that we get when we drive around here in Southern California, is actually contributing massive amounts of greenhouse gases and other problems to our local ecology and our ecology right around the globe. So there's another side to this. It isn't just about whether we gain or lose from the sociality of Facebook or the sociality of the cell phone. There's also the fact that there is the hidden environmental impact that is absolutely integral to what they do and largely hidden from all the rhetoric.
And all of these TVs and flat screens and computers, and the rate of obsolescence is extraordinary. And a lot of them are dumped in the third world, aren't they?
Well, this is a big part of the story. As everybody, I'm sure, knows, 2 or 3 years ago, we all had to get rid of our fat screen TVs that were the old analog ones and get our brand new spanking flat screen digital TVs. Now, again, there are some technological developments that are changing this, but by and large, the lovely flat screen digital TVs have required 3 times the amount of electricity as the old ones to run them. Not only that, but they also exude more heat, which often means, particularly in warm climates and in summertime, that people are utilizing more air conditioning while watching the flat screen digital TVs. So there are all kinds of impacts that come from that, quite apart from the fact that it's sometimes been argued that the television, the manufactured object, is the hardest manufacturing device of all, including cars, boats, anything you name, to recycle. And as you say, where those do get recycled is another story we can get onto in a second. And the other thing then about a mega event, say the Super Bowl,
right,
or the World Cup final, right, or the Champions League game that's coming up this Saturday, is that because vast amounts of people are all watching television at the same time, that means they're also breaking at the same time, especially in a game that's relatively uninterrupted,
right,
like a football game, i.e. a soccer game, where, right, you know, it's going to be nonstop for 45 minutes. That means that after 45 minutes, everyone's going to the toilet, everybody's boiling the kettle,
right,
everybody's opening the fridge. Well, of course, that means there's a massive power surge, a massive power rush.
Right.
So in countries where you're seeing simultaneous blasts, not only from the TV, but also in terms of the national grid, when it comes to these other events occurring every 45 minutes or every hour, you have to plan as somebody on the grid for these incredible surges. So, yes, I mean, one can be a real killjoy when talking about this, but I think it's very important for us to be responsible consumers, citizens, workers, you name it. So by all means, enjoy Bayern Munich really showing it to Chelsea at 11 a.m. Pacific time on Saturday. But as you do so, you know, turn the lights down and keep the air conditioning on. This year, it looks as though for the first time, expenditure worldwide on consumer technology devices will be $1 trillion. Last year, worldwide, $993 billion.
Mm.
Now, bodies like the Consumer Electronics Association here in the U.S., which represents the major manufacturers of these devices, says, you know, this is wonderful. It's a consumer's love affair with technology. Bodies that are pro-growth, like the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, say, well, when you have less developed or emergent economies that don't have effective national grids and don't have effective conventional landline telephone systems, isn't it marvelous that people who are conventionally disenfranchised and without communication are able to utilize, for instance, cell phones? And I don't want for a second to deny that there are benefits that flow from these, nor do I wish to suggest that I don't participate in them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I benefit from many of these devices. But I want us to be a little more aware of some of the costs as well as the benefits. Let me get back to the TV for a moment, if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Just across the border from where we are in Southern California, in Tijuana, in northwestern Mexico, there are, as many people will be aware, some listeners may have worked in these places, maquiladoras. Now, Tijuana was, in the early part of this century, just 7 or 8 years ago, the television set manufacturing capital of the world. As a consequence of lots of competition from Vietnam and China, and then some further problems, obviously, with the global recession, the number of TV sets made there in comparison to those other places went a little bit down. But right now, it's still about a third of the TV sets that come into the United States. The mostly women who are on the production lines for the big electronics companies, making not only TV sets, but let's focus on that for the moment, are working for well below the minimum wage here, are operating at very high levels of productivity, are reporting extraordinary degrees and levels of sexual harassment, are experiencing all kinds of fertility problems, birth defects, sickness, nausea, you name it. And just to get back to the consumer issue, if they were to buy one of the TV sets that they have made in Tijuana, it would cost them more than if their aunts, uncles, friends, or any of us bought the same TV set over the border in San Diego because of the way in which tariffs don't apply to products that go from Mexico to the United States, but do when they go in the other direction. there's lots of hope. There are lots of positive stories, and I think it's great if we devote some time to that. First of all, in terms of the positives, one of the incredible ironies, let's think about Fox News Channel, not a station probably that a lot of KPFK listeners are prone to enjoy, and I certainly don't as an individual. Nevertheless, remarkably enough, 5 years ago, Rupert Murdoch, the head of News Corporation that owns Fox, held his first ever global meeting of all employees, a virtual meeting in many cases, to talk about the 600,000-ton annual carbon footprint of the corporation. And he said, and I quote, "We must get our house in order." And he said that there must be a comprehensive program of offsets and decrease in emission of greenhouse gases by Fox, such that it hopes this year, 2012, actually, to have a zero carbon impact. Take the extraordinary vigilante right-wing TV show 24, very popular across the world for many years. The first ever carbon-neutral primetime US TV drama because of that initiative. Fox News Channel, populated, it appears, by climate change deniers, but actually powered by some of the greenest media technology in the world. So that's just
my
one.
God, that's amazing. So Murdoch is doing it at the technical level.
Yep.
And Ailes is still pushing global warming denial across the airwaves.
That's about audience targeting. You know, the people they target are not very educated, not very wealthy, very angry, not very urban, very white, very male people. And those are many of the climate change deniers in the United States. Remember, Murdoch is much more interested in money than power. And so are most of his disciples. Yes, they have ideological commitments. Right. But what matters most of all...
He knows how to spread money around in order to corral power, well, particularly in the United Kingdom.
We know about that. And it's not only about Fox. In fact, all the major studios, Warner Brothers was a prime mover in this, have got green initiatives that are quite significant. But what about the things that we can do as ordinary people, as consumers, as workers, as citizens, you know, in those three often overlapping, sometimes distinct roles that we have? On the one hand, we're the people who buy this stuff and who use it at work as well as at play. On the other hand, and I've always got three hands, we're the people who make it and who are part of the systems that utilize it. And on the third hand, we're the people who are part of the world environment in which it takes effect. So what can we do? Well, I'm pleased to say that gradually, slowly, right across the United States, thanks to citizen agitation, almost every state now, it's more than two-thirds, have enacted legislation. We have some in California to try to deal with this problem. So that's one area. Keep being the pressure on local governments and state governments. The second thing is put pressure on the federal government. We do not follow the Basel Convention, which is the major convention that prohibits the export of these substances once they've been finished with. You know,
you mean the waste products?
The waste products.
The e-waste.
The e-waste that goes principally to China and India, but also to Mexico, to Brazil, to Nigeria, you name it, and has extremely deleterious effects, horrendously deleterious effects on those working on it. Similarly, be militant about the fact that many of our federal prisoners who work for Unicor, the sort of federally owned monopoly company that is the employer, in inverted commas, of essentially slave labor in our prisons, mostly black men and brown men, African-American and Latino men, they are doing unsafe recycling of all these computer gadgets as part of their prison duties. So there's an impact we can make at home. There's an impact we can make by requiring the big companies like Apple, but not only Apple, like Hewlett-Packard, for example, to make absolutely transparent where their products are made, how their products are made, by whom, and what happens to them in their post-consumption life. It's essential that these corporations be the ones made ultimately responsible for the ecological and occupational health and safety impacts of what they peddle, not us as consumers. It's really crucial we do that. And there are lots of interesting non-government organizations, social movements, activists you can get involved with. I mean, just to mention two, the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, set up in Northern California, very important in dealing with these questions. And Greenpeace has done fantastic actions. They regularly appear at Apple's trade shows and make very strong activist statements about workers' conditions, but also about the ecological impact of all those lovely gadgets.
This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Farhad Mohammed. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.